Hey, welcome everyone to the March session of the 18th season of the Denver Community Coal Store for Tycoons program. Thank you, as always, to the Harry H. Barron Trust and Rabbi Zev Barron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we continue our 18th season. One unique announcement this month is that I'm excited to tell you that this coming week on Sunday, I'm sorry, Monday and into Tuesday, the Kollel will be having its 24th anniversary celebration. Now, this year is different than our usual celebration. We're not doing an in-person event. We're not even doing a Zoom event. But because we already had two events this year, two major events, our Chanukah Sabayis dedication event, as well as our Hachnosa Sefer Torah, that new Sefer Torah celebration. So instead, we are making a twist this year. We are having a major crowdfunding event. We're raising $675,000 over the course of those 2 days. Every dollar is going to be tripled by matchers. That'll be Monday, Tuesday of the coming week. And then Thursday, which is Purim, Thursday evening, we are going to be having a Purim celebration at the Kollel Torah Center in West Denver at 6:30, beginning at 6:30 p.m. That'll feature music, dancing, refreshments. And I encourage all of you, whether you donate or not, on Monday, Tuesday, everyone is invited to attend that gala, gigantic, stupendous Purim event. Again, Thursday evening, 6:30 p.m. If you get the cold emails, you have now no doubt seen about these events already, but here I am reminding you about it. And lastly, I want to encourage all of you to consider having a conversation with one of the Kollel rabbis about the Kollel's Live on Life and Legacy program organized here in Denver through Rose Community Foundation. It is helping the Kollel, continues to help the Kollel and many other Denver organizations create future financial stability through planned giving, such as wills, estate planning, and endowments. It's not as hard as you think it is. You don't have to be a rich man like Tevye or anything like that to be able to be a part of it. Anything can work and can secure your legacy for the future of Torah and Judaism here in Denver. With that, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce this evening's presenter, and that is Max Cohn. Thank you very much, Max, for being here this evening. He is the Deputy District Attorney for the Office of the First Judicial District Attorney. Max, the floor is yours. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. Can everybody hear me? Not if you can. We're all good? Okay, I'm seeing thumbs up.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
I've shared my screen, so I'm ready to go. By way of introduction, my name is Max Cohen. I am a prosecutor with the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office, which makes up the First Judicial District of Colorado. I've been doing that for about a year. And prior to that, I was a district attorney prosecutor as well in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office, which is in Rochester, New York. So this is what I've been doing for my career. And after speaking with Rabbi Fleischer, we decided that this was an interesting topic. So without further ado, I will get started. And the topic that I'm presenting on is something of recent interest, a parental negligence of a child's crime. So when a child commits a crime, what, if anything, can the parents be held responsible for? So most states have some version of a parental responsibility law where a parent or guardian could be held responsible for damages that their minors can cause. So examples, when a child brings a gun or a knife to school, when they're shoplifting, when somebody, when maybe a kid steals cars, or when there's vandalism involved. So the statutory law in Colorado is in Colorado for the Colorado rules. The parents of a minor living at home can be liable if the minor maliciously, willfully damages or destroys property, real or personal, belonging to another. And under the Colorado Revised Statute, Section 1321, 1075, if a minor is caught shoplifting, a minor's parents will be held financially responsible to the owner of the property. And so that's the statute. That's the case law that the legislature has come up with. When we turn to common law, that is basically derived from case law or precedent in the courts. There's some other laws as well. The common law can hold parents accountable For example, if a parent knows his or her child engages in certain activities in a careless or reckless manner, the parent may be considered negligent for failing to take reasonable steps to prevent the child from causing foreseeable harm. So those are the two ways that through legislation and then through cases that there is precedent for parents to be charged in or to be held responsible in certain crimes. Now, recently, there has been a case for the first time, I think first time in the history of the United States, where two parents of a child have been charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter based on the fact that their child went to a school and shot up the school and unfortunately killed four students and injured a teacher. And that is the People versus James and Jennifer Crumbly. And that is out of Michigan. And so both parents, James and Jennifer, are charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter. And the elements I just thought would be interesting, as if you were a jury, what the jury will hear in order for these two to be convicted of involuntary manslaughter, the state must prove that, number one, they caused a death. Number two, the death was without legal justification or excuse. And number three, that the defendants were acting or was acting in a grossly negligent manner. So it really seems that what is going to be in question here is whether they were acting in a grossly negligent manner. So the facts. So for those of you who are not familiar with this new case, the parents, James and Jennifer Crumley, are accused of giving their son, Ethan, access to a gun while disregarding signs that he was a threat. Ethan shot and killed four students and injured a teacher. In the days leading up to the shooting, Ethan was displaying extremely... Was that something? Okay, I'll continue.
Yeah.
In the days leading up to the shooting, Ethan was displaying extremely concerning behavior that alarmed school officials, alarmed them such that they actually called a meeting with the parents on the day of the actual school shooting. The guidance counselor was informing the parents of these concerning signs. They had the students' Ethan's math homework where he was drawing guns and had some pretty disturbing things written on paper. He told a friend, Ethan, that he asked his parents to take him to a doctor after having hallucinations and hearing voices. However, his parents apparently refused to take him to a doctor. When the police conducted a search of the Crumley home, the police found an empty gun case and an empty ammunition box seated on the bed in the master bedroom. The police found a gun safe in the dresser drawer in the master bedroom, but the gun safe did not have a lock on it. The police found no messages that indicated that Ethan ever told his parents the alleged plans for the shooting. However, there is evidence basically that the parents knew or could have known or should have known that he was experiencing some extreme mental anguish. And additionally, they bought him and they gave him access to that gun a couple weeks before the shooting. So the question that I have, and not only obviously it's in the American law system, is are the Crumleys going to be held responsible? So recently, the trial court, who is presiding over this case at a preliminary hearing stage, which is just a preliminary hearing to discuss whether there's enough evidence to go forward on these charges, ruled that both the Crumley's parents can stand trial for involuntary manslaughter. So at this point, the prosecution can bring the case to a jury trial and at that point present evidence and potentially have a jury decide. And the judge quoted was, after hearing extensive testimony as well as evidence in reviewing extensive exhibits, the court finds that the deaths of the four victims could have been avoided if James and Jennifer Crumley exercise ordinary care and diligence in the care of their son. And that was by District Court Judge Julie A. Nicholson. So the question that I'm asking, and you know, it's a very interesting case in the American law system that it is going to be, I think, watched and reviewed for the next few years or so while it's pending. I had a question for Rabbi Fleischer, and what does Jewish law say about situations like this? So at this point, if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to be available to answer any, but I will turn the floor over to Rabbi Fleischer.
Thank you very much, Max. If anyone has any questions, just unmute yourself, because I muted everyone to cut out background noise. So if anyone has any questions at this point, now's your big chance.
We're talking about a distinction between criminal law and civil liability, like a tort or something like that here. So, Max, if I understand you correctly, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of states that have various cases where the adults are held responsible for their children's actions and damages are awarded. What you're saying is that as far as you're aware, this is the first criminal case in this type of situation where the parents have actually conceivably held liable?
This is the first criminal case, at least in a like a school shooting context, where a prosecutor, the district attorney's office, has actually brought like involuntary manslaughter charges. So like basically treating somebody as if they had done or aided and abetted the crime as well. Obviously, there can be certain charges for, you know, in a civil context for negligence, but this is in a very distinct criminal context.
I had a quick question.
Yes.
I assume that this trial is under state law, not federal?
Yes, correct. It is under state law in the state of Michigan.
Okay, and laws vary on these things, I assume, from state to state?
Right. Like I just did a little research about the, like in Colorado, in terms of their state law, and there was the statutes that I put in the beginning of the slideshow. But then, yeah, it really varies. And in this case, it looks like the law is charged under, based on case law and statute in the Michigan law. So in Michigan, there's the involuntary manslaughter statute, and based probably looking at a bunch of cases in Michigan previous to this case, the prosecutor's office decided that they thought they had enough evidence to charge the involuntary manslaughter, which is a grossly negligent mens rea or state of mind. They decided they had enough evidence to charge that in this context.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. So thank you again very much, Max, for that presentation. And as always, if there are questions as we move along for myself or for Max, please feel free. I will attempt to stop talking every so often and give everyone a chance, you know, anyone who has a question or comment, the opportunity to weigh in. And of course, Max, if you have any comments as I proceed, please feel free to weigh in as well. So just to give everyone a heads up over here, from a strictly, you know, from the strict Jewish law standpoint, in terms of the sources, we're not going to come with a whole lot of liability for a parent on behalf of a child. We'll try to examine some sources and see what can be relevant in terms of a parent's liability. But in terms of, you know, the basic sources, we're not certainly not going to have, I guess we'll call the severity that Max showed us over here in American law. One source that's not on here, which I do want to just precede this conversation with, is we have an idea called Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, which means you cannot appoint an agent to perform a sin. Now, this is actually a broad discussion exactly how and where it applies and so on. But the basic idea is that if person A appoints person B to carry out a crime, something which is a sin according to Jewish law, he asked him to go damage someone or kill someone or anything in between. So the sender is not liable for the damage done by the perpetrator of the crime. Again, it doesn't make him a tzaddik. I'm not recommending honoring him at your shul dinner, because he is, in a certain sense, obviously responsible when his agent carries out the crime. But he cannot be convicted. He cannot be held accountable in a Jewish court of law for that crime. In most cases, there are exceptions. But again, it's a broad discussion, which I'm not getting involved in. That is true even in the case of a parent vis-a-vis a child. If a child goes ahead and does something at the parent's behest, the parent is not accountable. And certainly not if the child just goes in and does something and the parent was negligent. In general, the parent is not going to be liable. That said, let's see some of the sources and see where they take us and what we can learn over here. So off the bat, we have source number one is a Mishnah in Bava Kamma. And the Mishnah says a deaf person, a deranged person, or a minor. These three people, for those who are familiar with Talmud, these three types of individuals generally go together as people who are not generally considered accountable or responsible as fully functioning adults. I'm not getting involved in all the details of what is considered. A deaf person may be someone who is deaf, mute, and not really fully functional. There's a lot of debate. A person who simply is hard of hearing but is able to speak, is that person included or not? That's a whole discussion unto itself, which is not for now. A deranged person who is not of sound mind, and a minor. And again, from a halachic standpoint, a minor is not under the age of 18, but under the age of 13 for a male and 12 for a female. So the Mishnah says their contact is bad, meaning if you come into contact with them, you are in trouble. For one who wounds them is liable, but if they wound others, they are exempt. They are exempt if they cause damage to others because they are not considered fully functional individuals. However, if a functional adult causes damage to one of these people, then that individual is liable for the damage he causes. So off the bat, just the idea that a minor, again, according to halacha, that's much younger than according to American law, is basically off the hook. Not for now, the whole broad discussion, but there is a lot of talk. What happens when a minor grows up and then wants to make amends for stuff he's done as a child? Not unusual for a child to do things that he will later regret as an adult. It's not unusual for an adult to do things he will later regret as an adult. But certainly, it's not unusual for a minor to do things. And then when he gets older, he wants to make amends. Is he obligated to do so? Not really obligated. There are situations where it's advisable for him to make amends. Certainly, if he stole something and he still has the item in his property, he has to return it. But if he caused damage, or let's say he stole a candy bar and ate it when he was, 10 years old, does he have to go back to the store and pay it back according to the strict letter of the law? Not really. Some say if he knows, it's a nice thing to do. But basically, the bottom line is a minor is exempt for what he does from his own standpoint. Okay. The Torah makes it clear. The Torah says, father shall not be put to death because of sons. A person should be put to death for his own. That's a mistake. That should say sin. Whoops. That's a bad typo. Okay. You know what happens if you go over it? And spell check doesn't pick it up, and I missed it going over it. But that should be his own sin. I apologize for that. That's a bad typo over there. A person should be put to death for his own sin, not son. Please make a note of that. And apologies for that. So a person should be put for his own sin. In other words, the Torah is saying that a father is ultimately not taken to task for what his child does. Now, the verse over here is not talking about a minor per se. The Torah is just putting out the idea that everyone is responsible for his own actions, not for the actions of others. Again, those of you who are familiar with Torah and so on, you may have other verses that might indicate otherwise in certain scenarios, but this is the basic idea that the Torah puts forth. You are responsible for yourself. You're not responsible for the actions of other family members. However, that said, there is a mitzvah in the Torah, source number three, that says you shall not stand by your brother's blood. Okay, what does that mean? So again, a lot of discussion in the Talmud and in the halachic sources, but I've just quoted over here a passage from Maimonides, from the Rambam, in his Sefer HaMitzvos, his Count of the Mitzvos, he says, the Torah warns us against abstaining from saving the life of a Jew when we see him in mortal danger or a loss. In other words, if he is going to suffer a loss and we have the ability to save him. So Maimonides, the Rambam, again, based on the Gemara and the Talmud, is telling us that a person has an obligation to step in if you have the ability to stop another person from suffering bodily harm, financial harm, certainly mortal danger, as the Rambam over here says. There's a mitzvah in the Torah. That's an obligation. Now, this is not a mitzvah which one can be taken to a Beis Din, to a Jewish court, and prosecuted for, because it's passive. Any sort of lashes or execution, death penalty, cannot be levied or upon a person for a passive sin. It's a passive sin. It's sitting around and not doing anything. But it is a negative prohibition against standing by idly. It's right now being invoked quite a lot in the context of the unfortunate events, very tragic events taking place in Ukraine. This idea of don't stand by your brother's blood. You have an obligation to do it, to do something. So we're seeing it invoked a lot right now. But certainly there's no question that a parent who is aware of a child's proclivities towards problematic behavior would certainly have an obligation to do what he or she can to rein in that child's behavior and to protect others from that child's destructive behavior to whatever degree is reasonably possible based on this verse, because a parent very often knows what the child's tendencies are, what the child's proclivities towards these kinds of behaviors are. And therefore, certainly it would be the obligation and the responsibility of the parent to step in and to try to stop the child from engaging in that kind of behavior. Not always practical to stop the child, or at least to let others know if there is danger, certainly not to encourage or to enable any sort of destructive behavior by the child. That certainly would be a transgression of this verse. Okay. At the same time, number four, any obstacle that poses a danger to life. There is a positive commandment to remove it and to guard from it and to be very careful about the matter. As it says, guard yourself and guard your soul. This source I have brought up in many different contexts. And over here, I'm bringing it up in the context of making any sort of dangerous item, such as the case that Max discussed of the unfortunate events in Detroit, where the perpetrator of the crime, this child, Ethan, was able to get a hold of a firearm from his parents' home. And the parents, as it would seem, allegedly did not take the appropriate steps to keep it away from him. So I would venture to say that having a firearm in a home, certainly with a child who has problematic behaviors and tendencies and you know, some emotional issues, certainly I would say leaving that firearm, that gun accessible, would transgress this mitzvah of guard yourself and guard your soul, not to leave a dangerous item around. I certainly think that it would touch on that. So this is another prohibition in the context of which would apply certainly to a parent's responsibility vis-a-vis a child. If I have a gun in my home and, you know, there's a possibility, let's just say, of someone breaking into the home and stealing the gun, that probably wouldn't cross that line of having a dangerous item in my home, because within my own four walls, I'm being responsible with that weapon. However, to leave it available for a child, and I would venture to say even a child who is not prone to emotional instability and to, erratic behavior and so on, as was the case over here, apparently, in the case of this child in Detroit. But just having a firearm or a weapon that a child can take, and think it's a toy or fool around with it and cause damage, harm, death, God forbid, would probably touch on this as well. To leave a firearm, a weapon that a child can take and cause serious harm with, like a gun, I would assume would cross this line as well of leaving a dangerous item around. Okay, without getting involved in the everlasting political debate of do guns kill or do people kill, I think it's safe to say in an apolitical way that there is truth to both sides of that discussion. And so while the gun in of itself is not inherently dangerous if left to its own devices, however, leaving it around for a child to take is an irresponsible thing to do. And so therefore, I think leaving it around in any case is irresponsible of a parent that would probably transgress this mitzvah. Certainly, in the case over here where the child was not stable and was problematic and was displaying problematic tendencies, behaviors, and so on, certainly, I believe, would cross this line. Okay, so that is these are a few sources in terms of, again, the responsibility of a child and the fact that a parent is not really responsible in a liability sense for the child. But at the same time, we see some of the ideas of a parent's responsibility towards keeping an eye on and being responsible for the behavior of a child in terms of these two prohibitions. Now, before I go on, if there are any questions or comments, I'm happy to take them at this point. If you do want to say something again, you have to unmute yourself. No one? Okay. So, in that case, we will continue to source number five. So here we come to the next couple, the next few sources, again, are not going to discuss liability of a parent per se, but rather will focus on how the Torah views a parent whose child behaves inappropriately in a more general sense. Source number five is a Rashi in the book of Devarim. Those who raise the evil offspring shall be disgraced because of her. The Torah here is talking about a girl or a woman who was betrothed, and she is found to have been infidelitous during the period of her betrothal, which is forbidden by the Torah, and she's liable to death for that. And so is the man who had an illicit relationship with her. Both of them are liable to death. The Torah says that we basically publicize or carry out events near the home of her parents. Why? So Rashi says, those who raise the evil offspring shall be disgraced because of her. And here we have an idea that we're kind of placing the blame at the parents' door. Now, someone's going to cut me off over here and say, Rabbi, that's not fair. Who says it's the fault of the parents because they have a daughter who is behaving in an improper fashion? And the truth is, if you were to say that, I'm going to preempt your comment, and I'm going to say you're absolutely right. The reality is, I'll just backtrack for a moment with a passage in the Talmud that says that when a man is looking into marrying a woman, and again, as opposed to today, back in the day, you didn't have extensive dating or meeting of the two sides of the man and the woman before they got married. And if the man wants to find out what the nature of this woman is, so it says, check out her brothers. Yivdak b'achel. He should look into her brothers. Why look into her brothers? Because you can see what kind of family and what kind of household is going on by looking into the brothers. The great Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, who was the preeminent Torah authority in the early years, in the years before the state of Israel, the 1930s and 40s, and in the early years of the state until his passing in 1953, he commented that in today's day and age, this idea does not really apply. He explained that it used to be that a woman was brought up in the home. She was a product of the home. She stayed in the home by and large, and therefore you can probably guess what kind of person she was by looking at the home and at the products of the home. So men were more out in the world. And so a prospective husband who is looking into marrying this woman could check out the brothers and see what kind of household we are dealing with. Chazon Ish says in today's day and age, the reality is that both men and women are much more outside of the home. They have jobs often, and they're much more outgoing and so on. And therefore, that idea doesn't necessarily apply in today's day and age. So the Torah is referring to an idea that when you have a home where a woman, a girl, is raised in the home, and she tended to stay in the home, so then if she did not behave properly, then more often than not, the reason was because there was fault with the parents' approach to raising the child. Therefore, the Torah, to some degree, lays the blame at the doorstep of the parents. Again, does that mean it's absolutely their fault? Of course not. But there is blame placed to some degree at the doorstep of the parents because of the child's disgraceful, in this case, very illicit behavior. And so here we have an idea of the Torah recognizing that a child does tend to be the product of their upbringing by the parents. And if the child is behaving inappropriately, so then we can certainly look to the household and sense that there's a good chance that this child is behaving this way because of the upbringing and because of a lack of proper upbringing by the parents. Again, today's day and age, it's much tougher to make that application because in today's world, children are much more exposed to the outside world, interact much more with the outside world. But going back even a century, children were much less exposed. They were much more inside the home, and therefore they were much, much more a product of their household. Whereas today, it's much more common for children to go in very different directions, even very positive directions. but different directions from the kind of home in which they are raised because there's so much exposure. But again, the idea over here is the Torah holding the parents responsible for the behavior of a child. Okay, that brings us to source number 6. And this is what we call the discussion of a ben sorer umore. And I'm sure a lot of you have heard of this situation, what we call the wayward and rebellious son. And this is in Parshas Ki Tsetse. The Torah tells us that if a son is behaving in a very wayward and rebellious fashion, and he's very gluttonous, and he's eating enormous amounts of food and drinking enormous amounts of wine, stealing from his parents to fuel his habit, okay, of this very depraved lifestyle where he's just overly engaging in materialistic pursuits. So the Torah goes through a whole process, and again, the Talmud expands on this, on what exactly all the conditions are. But the bottom line is that it's possible to have a situation where you have a son, a child, who at a certain point in his process of maturation, around the time of his bar mitzvah, can engage in behavior where the parents are obligated to take him to Beis Din to first warn him, and then if he does not change his behavior, to actually bring him to Beis Din, where Beis Din will execute the child, will put the death penalty on the child because of the child's behavior. Okay, and the famous question is, the child didn't do anything that horrible. He stole money from his parents. He used it to buy meat and wine, which he ate on the parents' property. He had the chutzpah to steal the money, buy the food, and then go back to his parents' home and eat it there. And for that, we kill him? And that is the question raised by the Talmud, and Rashi quotes this. And Rashi says, the Torah arrived at the culmination of his way of thinking. The end will be that he will exhaust his father's money, and he will seek to maintain his habit, but not find it. And he will stand at the crossroads and rob people. The Torah says, let him die innocent rather than him dying guilty. Okay? Much ink has been spilled explaining the depths of this ruling. It's still hard to wrap your mind around it. How can you kill someone now based on an assumed future behavior? And there's, like I said, enormous amounts of discussion, and thinkers throughout the centuries are troubled by this. Some degree of perhaps of satisfaction and understanding this can be taken from the Talmud, which says that in fact, for all of the conditions to be met, to actually have a ben sorer umore, a wayward son, who is actually liable to the death penalty, the Talmud says it's impossible to actually meet all the conditions. To which the Talmud says, well, if that's the case, why does the Torah say it? And the Torah says the following very puzzling idea. It says, lahadlil Torah ulahadira, to make the Torah great and to glorify it. Which of course begs the question, why would God put random rules that are not applicable or relevant into the Torah just to enlarge the Torah and give us more rules? So I heard a very fascinating explanation from Rabbi Reuven Feinstein, the son of the great Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And Rabbi Reuven Feinstein is a great Torah scholar and leader in his own right. He is the head of the Yeshiva of Staten Island. And he's actually a Rebbe of our own Rosh Kollel, Rabbi Shachna Summers. And he said the following point. The Torah is telling us a very important point, and it's basically talking about the idea of addictions over here. Okay, what we're basically describing over here is a child who become addicted to a way of life that is unsustainable based on his own earnings. And the addiction will continue to spiral downwards until the point where he will become a highwayman who will rob and kill passersby. Because that is his ultimate point that he will get to, the Torah is putting out a warning. You're right, we may never actually have a case where all the conditions are met for him to be liable to the death penalty. But the Torah is describing to us an idea of the development of a child. If a child at a young age is allowed to engage in a lifestyle that is depraved, that is damaging, and just he's allowed to indulge in all of his materialistic desires and so on and so forth, you are creating a monster. This is an extreme case, obviously. But to allow a child to just indulge in all of his materialistic desires or all of his depraved ideas and so on, which may seem somewhat relatively innocent or somewhat innocuous at this point of life, but you are creating a monster. And that monster will ultimately go out and cause a lot of damage. So what I think we can pull out from here for our discussion is this idea that a parent has to keep an eye on the child, has to be aware of where the child is up to, and the parent has an obligation, the Torah is making an obligation and a responsibility on the parent to be aware of where the child is up to and to curtail behavior, which now might not seem the end of the world, but down the line can become very problematic. Okay, and I think we can apply that idea to our discussions that we're having over here in terms of this particular case in Detroit. And also at the same time, I think we can apply it in a broader sense to the responsibility of a parent when a child causes damage or so on. Just to go to the next source over here.
It seems to me that when you're sitting down and learning Torah with your son and you come to this pusuk, it could have a wonderful deterrent effect on the child's behavior. To learn that the word of God and the word of the community is, you know, you cross a line. And in particular, it's a kid who's not listening to his parents. So he may not show up for cheder either, but assuming he learns this passage, I would think that the deterrent effect would be rather great as well.
Okay, that's a good point. So you're saying that would be another lesson which can be effective for the child as well.
Yeah, it's, you know, letting the kid know that Hashem draws the line at delinquent behavior.
Right.
If it gets too far.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that thought. I think that there's a lot of truth to that as well. You know, we do have the idea, Proverbs, we say, Shema b'ni Musar Avicha, right? Listen, my son, to the Musar, to the ethical discourses of your father. V'altitash, and don't abandon the Torah of your mother. So the idea of the parents giving over those ideas to the child and the child understanding them and not abandoning them, I think is very important as well, as you say. All right. To tie up this particular source, Rashi continues a little bit later, and he says if his father and mother take pity on him, meaning they don't bring him in such a case to Beis Din and they allow him to just go along his merry way, the end will be he will go forth to bad ways and commit sins and be liable to the death penalty in court. And that is Rashi commenting that the very next section of the Torah after this first one talks about a situation of an individual who is committing sins that will bring indeed the death penalty down upon his head, and that he will be liable to be killed for his actions. So again, as Danny pointed out, we have the idea of the child getting the message from the parents, which is important for the child to understand that. But what I'm focusing on from my end over here is the Torah making it clear that a parent has a responsibility to be realistic about where the child's up to and not to take pity on a child. Now, again, as I said, to the extent of bringing the child to a Beis Din and the child will be executed is not something, as the Talmud says, which can actually occur in real life. But certainly the lessons of the parent's responsibility of, you know, as we say, spare the rod and spoil the child, you know, that rod has taken on different connotations in today's day and age. Again, going back to Proverbs, to Mishlei, the verse says, that if you afflict your child, then he will give you nachas. Okay, and without getting involved in past centuries parenting approaches, today most Torah authorities and mechanchim teachers and experts of child raising children will tell you that it is very rare, if ever, a good idea to actually use physical punishment with a child. However, the idea of punishing a child is what King Solomon, Shlomo Melech, is expressing. Don't spare the rod, whether the rod is, you know, back in the day, the good old patch, which I was subjected to on occasion, you know, but today may not go over well, and it may not be appropriate in today's world. But that punishment has to be there to just let the kid do whatever he wants to get away with it is problematic. And the parent has a responsibility to not just always take pity on the child, because if all you ever do is take pity on the child and let him get away with it, so then the child will just continue to spiral downward, and the parent has responsibility. I want to add to this before we go on to the next part of our discussion, that the sources say that even though a parent is exempt from damage caused by a child, however, some say that it is proper for a parent to pay for that damage. So let us suppose that a parent takes a child to a store and the kid breaks something. Technically, the parent is off the hook, as is the child. However, it would be proper, it would be the right thing to do for the parent to pay back the money. Okay. And certainly if you can make it a training opportunity, to take the child and to actually give the money to the child and have the child pay back the money so the child understands I did something wrong, I caused damage. That certainly is a good way to have the child understand that he's doing something wrong over here. Okay. So that is something I want to point out also, that it's not liable per se. The parent is not liable for damage caused by a child. However, there is an idea of the parent taking responsibility for the child's actions, certainly as a minor. Okay. Are there any other comments or questions before I get on to the next verses? Okay, so let me move on here to source number 7. Here we will start to talk about actual cases of liability, and I ask you all to bear with me because it is a bit complex. Source number 7, an object that is ownerless. Rav Huna said, if a person tied it to the leg, if a person tied it to the leg of a chicken and it caused damage, he is liable. So let me just paint the picture over here. There's a chicken hopping around, and there's a random object, a stick, or perhaps a pail, or some sort of object that can cause damage if it's swung around. And you go ahead and you take that ownerless object and you tie it to the leg of the chicken, and the chicken continues to hop around. And while it's hopping around, it's swinging the stick back and forth and breaking glass vessels that are laying around. So the Talmud says that you are liable for that damage, okay? Because you tied it to the chicken's leg. Now, we need to understand the following. There are specific categories of damage. Anyone who's ever learned Tractate Bava Kamma will know the very first Mishnah says there are four avos nizikin. There are four overarching categories of damage that come up. And there is damage done by an animal in eating. There's damage done by an animal as it walks. There is fire, and there is what's called bari, pit, which means any sort of obstacle that a person can trip on or fall into or so on. As the Talmud wants to know, the Talmud is giving this case, and the question is, which of the categories does this fall into? And so Tosfos over there says that he should be liable due to his fire, for it is akin to one stone, knife, or package that he placed upon a roof, and it fell in a normal wind, it damaged as it went, for this chicken is akin to a regular wind. Let me, I'll just quickly explain what this means. Okay. The Talmud says that if you went ahead and you took a rock or a knife or a heavy package, you put it on a roof in a windy, in a place where a normal wind is blowing, and it was precarious enough that it fell off the roof in a normal wind and caused damage on the way down, you are liable for that damage. Okay. Why? It's similar to a fire. What does a fire do? You leave it, and the wind comes and blows it, and it causes damage. You're liable if you lit that fire, or if you own that fire, or if you place that fire in a precarious place where the wind would carry it. You're liable for the damages it does, and this is no different. Okay? So says Tosfos, when you tie this stick, whatever, this object, to the chicken, you are essentially, this chicken is like the wind. It is the force that will cause this stick to go forth and cause damage. And therefore, you are liable. Okay, Tosfos continues, and he says, not necessarily where it was tied. In other words, you don't have to necessarily tie the item to the chicken. The same applies if it was previously in a secure place, and he put it in an exposed place, for he was negligent with it. So here Tosfos adds the idea. I don't have to tie the stick to the chicken. Let's say I have a strap, a wide, broad strap, and it was in a secure place where it wouldn't get caught on the chicken's feet, and I take it out and I put it outside where the chicken walks around, hops around, and now this strap gets caught, wrapped around the chicken's foot, and now it's running around and the strap is waving back and forth, causing damage. Says tells us I am liable. Why? Because I was negligent with the item. I left it in an exposed place. And that's how it ended up causing damage. So it's the same thing. Says tells us I don't have to actually tie it to the chicken. I can just leave it in an exposed place in a negligent fashion, and I'm still liable because it's akin to leaving a fire in a place where the wind can blow it. Okay? And this is indeed the ruling of the Rama in Choshen Mishpat, where he says, if the strap belongs to someone else, the owner of this trap is liable, assuming that he left it in an exposed place, whether the chicken damaged as it dragged it or when it threw it. Since he failed to hide it away, it is his. So here the Rama again makes the case that if you have a chicken that is ownerless and it got a strap tangled around its leg and the chicken hopped around causing damage, so then the owner of the strap, or as we saw in Tosos, even if it's not owned, but an individual took it and left it in a place which was negligent, so he created this reality of leaving it in an exposed place, he is liable. Okay, so what is the upshot of this? Well, we're not talking about chickens. We're talking about children. But some want to make the argument. I saw that there are contemporary halachic sources who want to make the argument that a child, a minor, is akin to the chicken. Why? Because a minor is not responsible for his actions. So in a certain sense, a child is akin, is similar to this chicken in that just like a chicken doesn't have its own mind or not its own intelligence to hold itself back from causing damage, a child is prone to doing things and also is not of a mature mind. And if I leave something in a situation where a child will be able to take that item and cause damage, so then I may be liable for it. So let us suppose, let's leave, going back to the case over here that took place in Detroit with this tragic case of the parents who basically left the gun in a situation where the child was able to get it. Essentially, the argument could be made that these parents were negligent leaving this firearm, this weapon, in an exposed place. And by leaving it in an exposed place, the child essentially was able to take it and to wreak havoc with it, to murder people and so on. So the argument can be made that the parents should be liable, at least financially, for the damage caused by this firearm. Again, going back to the question, do guns kill or do people kill? And again, my point that there is truth to both sides of it. Over here, the child is akin to the chicken because the child doesn't have his own mature state of mind. And this firearm was left in a negligent fashion by the parent. So the argument could certainly be made that the parents are liable, at least financially, for the damage done by leaving it for the child to be able to access it and then to go cause damage. By the same token, if the child would cause just financial damage with a firearm or any other sort of weapon, okay? So then again, the argument can be made that the parent is responsible, is liable, because by leaving it out there, the parent is being negligent. Now, how far would that go? I don't know. Let us suppose a child goes and buys, I'm sorry, let us suppose a parent goes and purchases a bat for his son to play baseball. And the kid goes out to the yard and he plays baseball in the yard and he hits the ball through the neighbor's window. Shall we say then that the parent is responsible because he gave a bat to the child and the child can put a ball through the window? And therefore the parent is liable because it's like leaving that strap for the chicken to get tangled in its legs? I'm not sure. If it's in a situation where it's likely the kid's going to hit the ball through the window with normal use, maybe you can make that argument that the parent left it in a negligent situation because he knows the kid's going to play ball in the yard and that yard is right next to the neighbor and there's a window right there overlooking their yard. And so there's a good chance the kid's going to hit the ball right through the window. Conversely, if the kid takes the bat and goes up and down the block smashing windows with it on cars, you can make the argument that that wasn't negligent per se on the parent's part, because normally a child doesn't go around smashing windows if the child has a tendency and a history of doing it. So then maybe the argument is, well, there, that's called negligent. That's called like leaving it in a normal wind and it's going to get blown off the roof, because that's what this child does for a living. He goes around smashing windows. So it's hard to put an exact line on where that line would be crossed of parental negligence. But certainly the idea that you see from this passage of Talmud that leaving an object for a chicken, that it will get stuck and get caught on the chicken's feet, or tying it to the chicken and giving that chicken the opportunity to cause damage, renders the person who did that liable, can be applied to a child causing damage with an object as well. Okay, so that is a source for potential liability in certain cases where a child is going ahead and causing damage with an item that was provided or at least made available in a negligent fashion by the parent. Are there any questions or comments at this point? Okay, so if no one has anything to say, I'll just I'll just go through the last couple of sources over here, and I may actually finish on time for once. So let's see. Source number nine. One who stands his fellow's animal on his fellow's standing grain is liable. On doesn't actually mean on. It means next to in the context. And the Talmud is making the following point. If I take your cow and I stand your cow next to your grain or someone else's grain for that matter, and the cow is hungry, and I know good and well when I put this cow next to the grain, the cow is going to eat the grain. I am liable. Now, it's not my cow. It's your cow. It's your cow, but I am putting the cow next to the grain. I am liable for placing the cow right next to the grain. Why? We have an idea called Bari Hezekah. Bari Hezekah means the damage is very likely. In all likelihood, this cow is going to go ahead and eat that grain. And therefore, even though it's not my animal, because I put it in that situation where it is very likely to cause that damage, then I am held liable for the damage it does. Okay? So, again, there are a lot of details and offshoots of this halacha, but what is relevant is a passage in a sefer called Nachlas Eliyahu, where he addressed the following question. Regarding one who came with a small child to his fellow's house, and the child went on the table and broke vessels and caused damage, is he liable to pay or not? Okay, apply this to any situation where you have a kid whom the parent brought along somewhere where the parent would have been advised not to bring the kid. All right? And the child went ahead and caused damage in a situation where the parent knew it was likely the child was going to cause that damage. Okay, you don't bring a child into a china shop. So if the kid certainly is a wild kid and you bring him into a china shop and the kid, you know, runs around and causes all sorts of damage, can the parent just go ahead and say, sorry, it's not me, it's my kid, and I didn't do anything? So he answers and he says, it would seem he is liable to pay due to the reasoning of one who stands an animal by his fellow standing grain, where he is liable to pay if the damage is likely. Here, too, if the damage is likely, he is liable. So this Sefer Nachlas Eliyahu, who was written by Rabbi Eliyahu Deshintzer, who lived, I think, about 100 years ago or so, he wants to argue and say, he wants to make the case and say that taking a child and putting that child into a situation where he is likely to cause damage will render the person who puts him there, in this case the parent, liable for that damage. So taking it back to our case over here of this tragic situation in Detroit, of the parents who had a gun in the house and it was accessible to the child who had emotional issues, who was unstable, who clearly had a lot of problems going on, and leaving that gun available for the child was asking for trouble. Can one make the argument and say that it was very likely that by leaving that gun around for a child who clearly has issues and murderous intentions and so on was akin to standing the animal by the grain, and therefore the parents should be liable? One could make that case. Again, practically speaking, in a Jewish court of law, would it hold up? I don't know. But certainly one can hear the argument and make the case that in this type of situation where they knew the child was unstable and they knew the child had serious issues, and they knew the child, perhaps they knew, was, had murderous intentions and so on, this may well be akin to standing an animal by the fellow standing grain, in which case the parents would be liable for the damage that the child did. In such a case, it wouldn't be limited to a parent per se, but really anyone who would go ahead and do that. So that's another source and something to think about in terms of what a parent's liability might be for the damage a child causes, both in this case of murder as well as other scenarios. Like I said, if you bring a child into a store where there's a lot of delicate things around, which he could easily, if he runs around a little bit or jumps around as children tend to do, he could break it. Okay, that sign that says, please do not touch. And if you touch it and it breaks, you will have to pay for it. There's a reason the store owner puts that sign up there. Okay, and so bringing the child there where the kid is, if he's a normal child, he's going to jump around and cause damage, the parent may very well be liable. I want to add one more thing, and that is that the halachic authorities say that if a store owner or a homeowner puts a sign in his store, as I just said, that says, if you break it, you pay for it, then if anyone comes in and causes damage, then even a child, in such a case, the child would be liable. Because when you walk into my property and there's a sign there that says, if you cause damage, you are liable, or if your child causes damage, then you are liable. So you are walking into my property, essentially agreeing to those conditions. If you walk into my home and I tell you verbally, or if you walk into my store and I tell you verbally, or I have a sign hanging there that is visible that says, if your child causes damage, you are liable, then you have walked into my property agreeing to those terms and conditions. And then standard halacha is irrelevant. You have essentially agreed to those terms and conditions, and you are held to those standards. So any situation in the question of a child causing damage, where if you walk into a store and it says clearly that if a child comes in and causes damage, the parent is liable, so then all bets are off. It's very clear that in such a case, the parent would be liable because the parent has essentially agreed to those terms. In the absence of that, I think we would have to go back to these cases that we spoke about over here. Number one, can you argue that the parent was negligent in leaving an item, an object for the child to do damage with? If the child took a bat that the parent owned, or a firearm and caused damage, or so on and so forth, or a ball for that matter, and the parent knew that it's very possible that the child could cause damage, that might be akin to leaving the strap laying around where the chicken hops around. And the second question would be, did you put the child into a situation where he is very likely to cause damage? That would be a second scenario where potentially there would be liability as well. I want to make clear that there is a lot of discussion over the nature of this liability of standing the animal by the grain. Some argue that it's limited to animals, not to humans or children for that matter. But some do want to say that it is applicable in this case. So those are some of the sources. Again, just to conclude, in general, a parent is not strictly speaking liable for what a child does. However, as we saw before, there is a general responsibility to prevent damage or dangerous situations from occurring. And certainly a parent has that obligation vis-a-vis the child. And we've seen the Torah's expectations of a parent to take responsibility for the behavior of a child to whatever degree is possible, and not to just look the other way and say kids will be kids, but no, to properly take into account a child's behavior and act accordingly and administer punishment or as necessary, if necessary. And lastly, perhaps some cases where there is actual halachic liability. Okay, so if there are any questions at this point?
Yes.
I'm happy to take them. Go ahead.
Okay, so in the case that we started with, are the parents liable?
In the case we started with, of which case that we started
the
with?
The current case, who bought the gun for their son.
So again, I'm not sitting on a bezin to rule. I'm just pointing out that based on these sources at the end that I'm bringing, one could certainly make the argument that leaving a gun lying around might be akin to this strap getting stuck on the chicken's leg, or it might be akin to standing an animal over the grain. If you are leaving a gun easily accessible to a child who is known to have, you know, emotional issues and murderous proclivities because of his instability, you could make that argument. Again, I want to make clear also, the case over here is for a child who is over the age of 13. So according to halacha, the child is on his own either way and has his own liability. So it wouldn't necessarily be the same thing. He's considered a mature adult. Okay. If the child is considered a shote, a deranged person, so then the law would be similar to that of an under bar or bas mitzvah child. And it does seem like the child had issues. Whether that would render him a halachic shote, a deranged person, is very much up for debate. So it's not a clear answer. I'm just making the argument that, you know, a bezin, if they would be considering this case, would consider that in terms of financial restitution. Certainly they're not liable for the murder itself in terms of capital punishment. That is for sure. But in terms of financial responsibility, perhaps these are arguments in those terms.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Okay, so we'll end here. Okay, we are a minute over time. I have to go over time and drop. But thank you all very much for coming. Thank you very much, Max, for joining us this evening. And if you have any final comments, now's your big chance.
Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate being here.
All right. Thank you for joining us. Thank you all of you for joining us. Keep an eye out. I haven't decided yet for April because it is right around, that's pretty close to Pesach already. We'll see where things are up to. So thank you all for coming. And a reminder, this Monday, Tuesday, don't worry, you'll all be getting emails about that campaign. And again, you're all invited Thursday evening for the Kollel Purim celebration at the Kollel Torah Center at around 6:30 p.m. Everyone have a great night. Take care. Be well.